happy anniversary. It was 1 year ago this week that Bring to Mind podcast began, traveling to the campus of Trinity International University. We talked with Dr. Michael Sleesman, Managing Director and Research Scholar. He's an affiliate professor of bioethics for Trinity Graduate School, and he's served as an adjunct instructor and online course tutor at the college and graduate levels in the areas of philosophy, theology, and ethics. His particular area of specialization is the interconnection of technology and culture assessment. We visited with him again in the library of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity to talk about technology advancements of the past year and how people of faith might thoughtfully interpret them. Well, Michael, you are our first guest on the Bring to Mind podcast. You will always hold that position. And we wanted to catch up with you again. Started in October 2012. We talked that first visit about cultivating our minds as people of faith. And I thought maybe a year later we could just revisit that as we kick off our time with you again. How do you define that? How is cultivating the mind any different for a person of faith from somebody else who's not a person of faith?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you again for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to join you again, and congratulations for the past year and all of the success that you've had with this podcast series. I've been following it and was encouraged to see some of the discussions with even with multiple guests on various episodes and just the wide range of topics you've been covering. So just really want to encourage you in this work that you're doing. For me, the Christian life of the mind really comes from this sense that we have as human beings, that God has created us to be imaginative creatures, that we have minds that we can use to profane God, but also to glorify God. And so for me, the life of the mind is about encouraging and fostering our flourishing as human beings to explore this creation that God has made, to learn about what it means to live in this world, and to learn how to best encourage others to promote their well-being and this notion of human flourishing. So to me, the life of the mind helps us to not just be passive observers in this world, but to actively engage in everyday life.
And so for people of faith, what is that, just that moniker, people of faith, what does that add to that conversation of cultivating the mind?
So the life of the mind isn't something that would only be for Christians. This is something that anyone should and can cultivate to as I think the last time we spoke, we talked about this metaphor of exercising the mind muscle. And but specifically for people of faith, it's this recognition that we live in a world that God has created, and that the life of the mind is something that we explore not just at a fact-based data level, but actually has to do with the core and purpose and meaning of existence. And so the life of the mind helps us to better understand our place in this good creation that God has made.
I'm not an academic, but I would add in the words be aware as
yes.
well.
I would agree, yes.
As people of faith, because one thing I watch in evangelicalism from my vantage point here in America is more of an attitude to react rather than to respond, and to judge rather than to question.
And that is unfortunately all too often the case. I'm often impressed by this image of these bugs that skim across the surface of water, right? And how often that really depicts, I think, the everyday experience of most people in general, but also, unfortunately, too often people in the church. And we see this from the level of culture, from the level of technology and science, in politics. Unfortunately, we see it at many levels, and so it's as if we're all asleep at the wheel at a very important time in our lives and in human history, and unfortunately, not being the influence that we can be as Christians in this world.
about the past year and what's new in technology, some of the shifts that are out there. What's on your radar?
Well, the maxim that things continue to change is certainly the case in science and technology over the past year. Some really exciting things, some developments in the area of 3D printing, not just in commercial activities, but the idea of the old jet printers that many of us may have been aware of, Jet Ink. And so they've created these printers now that don't just print paper, things on paper, rather, but actually can print 3D objects themselves. And some of the more exciting and challenging opportunities are not just that they can print things like art or vases or cups or those things, but also as they move into the area of biotechnology. And so the possibility of printing things like organs, not something on the near horizon, but somewhere down the road. A very interesting case happened just a few months ago where, the details I don't recall exactly, but I believe a young girl came into an emergency room and was having trouble breathing, had serious problems that were contributing to this, but one of them was that air was not getting to her lungs because of some problems with her windpipe, and the doctors were able to basically image her windpipe and print a 3D printing of that windpipe and install it into her. And it was able to keep her alive for some period of time. And that's just the beginning of possibilities here. It does raise profound issues, though. This is what we would refer to as a disruptive technology, changing the marketplace, in a sense. Think if you never had to worry about finding that broken part on your refrigerator that you can never seem to be able to order, and all you would have to do is download the file from a website and print it, and you could have it available, or something, the handle on your vacuum cleaner. Changes the way that we see consumer products and their repair, but also raises profound issues like thinking about safety issues. What if you could print a gun in this manner? And that's been discussed as well.
I'm not sure I even fully understand what you were just describing, but here's what I caught. It can be used to save life. And I think that's a phrase that, while it used to bring a lot of joy, oh yeah, great, now sometimes I have a little bit of concern when I hear that, because I'm not quite sure about the technology involved to save life. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And so there. When we talk about this, there are lots of questions that come with it. Sometimes saving life becomes an end in itself, and that can get out of control, because maybe we make decisions that are based on some end, but we're willing to sacrifice moral decision-making in the intermediate. And that wouldn't necessarily be the case with some of these technologies, and 3D printing, that might not be the case here. But there would be some technologies where we could say that the goal would be to save life or to improve life, but in the end, we end up having to sacrifice life to get there. Mm-hmm. And one of those examples historically has been embryonic stem cell research. And that's something that was promoted in the media for quite some time as being this sort of panacea, this cure-all. And fortunately, what we've seen actually over the last few years is rapid developments in alternatives that don't destroy human life, what are referred to as induced pluripotent stem cells, or discoveries that have been made related to adult stem cells. And those are examples of how we can continue to pursue saving life without sacrificing life.
Are those new developments as widely received, as well received?
Some of them are. There continues to be challenges in that, just as any field, certain areas of science and research tend to become entrenched in ways of thinking, but industry seems to be moving in a direction that is recognizing the value of pursuing some of these alternatives. And so we're seeing actually a rapid acceleration of discoveries in what would be more life-affirming kinds of technology.
You have to be happy about that.
Yes. Yeah, it's very encouraging.
Yeah. Okay, what else?
Another development was something that President Obama had mentioned a few months ago, and that was the BRAIN Initiative. This is an equivalent of the Mapping of the Human Genome Project, except for now the human brain. As much as we understand about human biology and our anatomy and physiology, and think about fields like psychology and when people struggle with various disorders or psychological conditions, depression, and other things, there's so much we don't understand about the brain, so much that we really are not clear of why things function the way they do. And so the BRAIN Initiative is very exciting in the sense that it could bring a great deal of understanding to our knowledge of how the brain functions. But with that comes a great deal of responsibility as well. For instance, if we are able to discern how memories function and we have the ability to, in a sense, maybe help people with post-traumatic stress disorder deal with the memories that they have that are causing distress for them. If we were able to remove those memories, is that a positive or negative thing from a moral standpoint? And if it can be done with people with ailments, it can certainly be done to people that do not have those disorders.
Yeah. So sounds both good and also like a bad movie.
Yes.
You know?
So skip all of those years of primary and secondary education, do the digital upload, right? Plug yourself into the computer, get your latest upgrade. Yeah.
Well, what I was thinking, you were talking about post-traumatic stress syndrome, and wouldn't it be wonderful to just put that away? Yeah. There's this other part of me, and I'm not someone who has suffered with that, that says, but isn't that part of our journey?
And so I think we
you know,
with many
a theological
of these, yeah,
sense.
These issues, that it's recognizing the genuine distress that someone suffers through in encountering these, but also at a theological level, realizing that not and I want to be very careful here, that not all suffering is something that must be avoided. And so, and I'm not saying in any way that this is a suffering that shouldn't be avoided.
Right. Neither of us want to judge that. I mean, the minute that came out of my mouth, I thought if I was a sufferer listening to this, I'd throw the device down right now, maybe, you know, through which I was listening to this, because I don't know what that's like. And who am I to say?
And that's, I think, one of the challenges that when we face these issues is that we want to affirm the genuine tragedy of human suffering. And at the same time, recognize that the removal of all suffering may not necessarily make us better people. And so there's a tightrope there that has to be walked, because just the sheer act of removing all human suffering, I'm not speaking about any individual manifestations of human suffering, but just the sheer act of removing all human suffering would not necessarily make us better people or promote our flourishing as human beings.
Or as people of faith, we like have this relationship with suffering like nobody's business. You know, we embrace it, you know. Christ, you know, the wounded healer. So we do make space for that. But,
yes.
You know, when we're talking about the brain and trauma and mental illness, you know, those are real difficulties.
Absolutely, yeah. Really,
for which a verse of scripture is not there to cure it.
That's right.
Yeah. So the brain mapping, some things to watch.
Yeah, and some of the, I think, more interesting things is the Defense Department is also very interested in this area and is actively engaged in the BRAIN Initiative. And
oh, that sounds like a really bad movie.
Yes. So that raises a whole host of other questions, which maybe you can save for a different expert.
Whoa. Yeah.
Thank you.
here's something, I don't know if it's shifted or not, or if it's more of the same. Josh, our producer, and I were talking, actually on our way to your office today, about a mutual friend of ours who is a college professor, and he is very disturbed by social media. He has seen kids in his class, you know, on their phones, of course, or behind a screen, you know, and in your lecture, you know, and who knows what they're doing behind their screen while they're sitting facing him giving a lecture. He just felt like it was just, it's destructive, it's destroying relationships, we on and on, you know, we're not relating with each other face to face and so forth. I'm wondering if you've noticed any shifts. I would just say there's more to be in our face over the past year.
Yeah. As an educator, this is something we continually see, the recognition that education now demands more attention to presentation than it ever has before. There are so many things that are competing with our students' attention and, frankly, with our own. And I think we see that in the marketplace and in the classroom alike. There's a book that Sherry Turkle, an MIT psychologist, has written, I think it's within the last 2 or 3 years, Alone Together. And one of the things that she highlights in there is this interesting irony, really, that the very technologies that were attempting to bring us together have actually taken us apart, or keep us apart. And so isn't that a strange reality, that we're more connected to more people than we ever were at any point in human history? And yet, how many people are more alone than they ever were before? And part of that is, I think, the loss of personal relationship and the increased reliance on mediated relationships. Social media are great tools for amplifying our voices, but they are not the same as being in a coffee shop with someone having a conversation.
I'm not sure it's even the same voice.
Yeah. And that's something else that has arisen in the recognition that we create personas. And this, either it's this idea of ego casting or this sense that we explore alternate ways of seeing ourselves through online media and especially social media. How are we presenting ourselves? And so this term ego casting has arisen in the last few years to try and describe this phenomena of self-promotion. And the we see that certain technologies, social media technologies, feed into this more than others. I think of when Twitter first came online and some of the tweets that you would see, you know, basically somebody would be narrating their entire day. It's like, really, did we need to know every single one of those moments? And part of that is just self-discovery of what the technology will bear. But there is so much noise in our everyday existence, whether it's from advertisers and marketers, whether it's the various things that we're doing at work, the ways that we're being pulled, all of the information messages, and social media contributes to that as well.
I wonder if we're losing vulnerability. When we're face to face, we can still be ego casting, as it were, but there's also that human contact that elicits vulnerability. We can read others. We can sense a look, you know, the curve of lips or what we see in eyes, and it tells us something and invites us into another's life or creates a safe space, you know, for us to be vulnerable. We don't have that in social media.
That is, I agree. I think the interesting thing is to see how the younger generation has responded to these technologies in ways that are maybe somewhat different than their parents, and seeing the maybe lack of awareness that they have that this is being distributed or disseminated widely. And so you have a sense of vulnerability or exposure that maybe isn't even appropriate.
And so a different kind of vulnerability.
Yes. And so people sharing very intimate aspects of their personal life or knowledge about themselves that they, you know, would be absolutely abhorrent to find that maybe somebody in the room that they don't know would know because they follow them on Facebook, their friends, or LinkedIn or something.
Would they say that same thing face-to-face with another?
Yes. And so I've encountered some of those. I teach a class in Trinity College every other year, computer ethics. And one of the things we talk about is the way that the online environment has changed relationships and continues to evolve our understanding of what it means to be in community and interpersonal communication, and to raise this awareness that when we put things on the internet, we don't control them in the same sort of way that we do in writing, for instance.
Well, a big change this year was the whole NSA, and is the government getting our Facebook information, and is Google giving stuff? I mean, that just, I think, shocked a lot of, everybody.
Yes.
Big brother.
Significant, profound questions about privacy, confidentiality, a number of issues. So.
Do you think that will change in the next year? Are things going to be put into place on our behalf, or is it more of the same?
Well, I don't know that I'm in the best position to actually speculate what will happen from a regulatory standpoint.
Yes.
I think one of the things that I would suggest is looking at the trend in terms of where the younger generation is on the privacy issue, and going back to that disclosure issue in terms of their willingness to reveal things that previous generations would have considered inappropriate or considered to be very personal information, and just make that widely available. And I think that the trend of social media is towards openness and away from privacy, towards disclosure. And I read a book not too long ago, a novel, a science fiction novel, where one of the premises, I guess, was this issue of privacy, and the way that these interpersonal relationships happened were through this transaction of a give-a-lot. And the idea is you walked up to someone and instantly they recognized your privacy settings. And so this is a sort of augmented reality in which you determine when you walk up to a stranger what kind of information they would know about you. And so, if we could speculate a few years out from seeing Google Glass maybe emerging in the last year to a time when maybe we're all walking around with glasses that give us useful information so we don't get lost getting from point A to point B, or as you're approaching some stores letting you know that, you need to pick up the milk and it's on sale here, or, you walk up to an appointment and it gives you the whole dossier of what you were supposed to remember in the appointment, or as you're walking in the street by strangers and who these people are and what their personal likes are and dislikes.
There it is again. Sounds like helpful for life, but there's a little question attached to it. Something that I noticed this year was on Twitter, how it could be self-destructive. I think a lot of celebrities, nothing comes to my mind right now, but I know celebrities who had to, delete tweets, and business people, just the power for people to rise up and, in an instant, your celebrityism or your little kingdom could be over.
Well, that the issue of celebrityism might be a whole nother conversation, but it's certainly the amplification of power of the individual voice, and in a way that I think is exciting in the sense of the democratization of power, in the way that everyday individuals can garner immense following and can be hugely influential in a way that is maybe at no other point in human history. And yet that comes with immense responsibility, right? So the recognition that when you're doing things online, when you're posting on Facebook, on Google+, on Twitter, on the whole litany of possibilities for social media, on a blog, on a podcast, being mindful of the kind of voice that we have, about thinking about what we're saying. And unfortunately, many of the ways that these social media technologies function is that they mitigate against the critical thinking. How much can really be said in 134 characters? How much can you really communicate? And so one of the things that begins to do is to change the way that we think. We're constantly being bombarded by sound bites, and we're being enculturated in a social media environment in which we're encouraged to think in sound bites. Sound bites don't always convey careful thinking, and rarely convey careful thinking.
I'm probably going to ask you something that you don't really ask an academic, but anyway, what are your own frameworks? I'm going to get personal. What are your own standards, frameworks for social media? What are you putting together for your own family? You know, way of thinking. How are you figuring all that out?
So the great irony of teaching a course on computer ethics, and so I try and incorporate some of the things that we talk about in class, and to be mindful. I'm extremely vigilant about our familial privacy, and I would encourage others to think about what they're doing. I'm always alarmed when I see individuals sharing things about going on vacation, and you know, it's like, really? That's widely available. Do you really want that to be known, that your house is unoccupied for the next several weeks? So I think just some common sense things there, but also really thinking through the nature of why we're on these technologies. So a lot of times the negative things come up. There's lots of positives to them. I think of the relationships that I'm able to keep up on through Facebook, and seeing people share their photos, things to events that I would never be able to attend, to get updates on things that they thought were important, sometimes are unimportant. But it's also good to see that drip, drip, drip of everyday life, right? And yet, at the same time, that's not the same as being there with them. And I think that's the step that we have to remember, is that these are mediated relationships. It's not the same as living in the other person's life. They have no awareness that you know those things.
I mentioned at the beginning of our time together, Michael, that you were our first guest here on the Bring to Mind podcast. And since then, we have been on the hunt for stories of faith lived out in unique places. So maybe circling back to where we started today, as we cultivate the mind as people of faith, and you know, another year before us, how can we, particularly as people of faith, how can we be mindful, and what are a couple things to keep in mind as we head into another 12?
I think each of us should commit to becoming more informed about some area of life. And I would really challenge each and every listener that this is a really important exercise. We live in a really complex world, sociologically complex, economically complex, a global world in which there are political ideas that are thrown around, competing theological commitments, philosophical commitments. And if we don't become more informed about these things, they push us. They'll still push us, but they won't push us blindly. And so maybe in this next year, maybe it's learning a little bit more about science, for instance. There's been a big interest in improving STEM, this science, technology, engineering, and mathematics awareness, especially in elementary and secondary education. And I believe we talked about this last year, but this reality that we live in a technologically and scientifically sophisticated era, and very few people understand any of the things that we use. and maybe that's just not appropriate anymore. Maybe it was never really appropriate, but we got by. Unfortunately, we're making decisions on a continual basis, and so we need to be mindful that we're making decisions. Maybe that involves thinking about the next phone that you buy and why you need that phone. Maybe it is why you need to upgrade to an even bigger and higher definition TV. Maybe it's about being environmentally mindful about some of the implications of the technologies that we make use of every day. Or maybe it just means learning about more about the human body so that when you go into the doctor's office, you can make informed decisions. So I think there are a whole host of areas within the science, technology, engineering, mathematics realm that we could become more mindful of, but maybe it's as simple as just picking up a newspaper on a regular basis and forcing ourselves to read something that we wouldn't have read any other way.
Dr. Michael Sleesman, Managing Director and Research Scholar of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Dr. Sleesman was our first guest on the Bring to Mind podcast 1 year ago this week. We posted resources on our homepage that you might enjoy looking at, including the book Dr. Sleesman co-edited, Everyday Theology, How to Read Cultural Texts and Interpret Trends. It's been used as a college textbook and has been distributed in Korean and Chinese traditional script, as well as English language for Indonesia editions. And this week we're giving away, as Josh has put it, a massive book package from resources we've talked about over the past year. Check it out on our Facebook page, find us at Bring to Mind Podcast, and on Twitter at BTM Podcast. Next week, Dr. Bruce Ellis Benson with both a lighthearted and challenging conversation about how philosophy influences current theology. And don't forget, if you want to connect with us, you can do that at our website homepage, bringtomind.org.